Welcome to the Equestrian Experience, a show we talk about what happens behind the rosettes and what we've tried so you don't have to. In a world first, we and our guests will be openly sharing what we know from our extensive equestrian experience. This includes our exclusive access to global experts such as high-performance national vets, coaches, farriers, and even brands. If you're new here, consider subscribing. We're your hosts, Bex Mason and Amanda Ross, and today we're talking to my greatest mentor and overall wizard equestrian in my eyes is Elizabeth Launder from Hartbury University Therapy Centre. Hi there, Liz. Thanks for coming on today. Really looking forward to chatting to you.
Good morning.
And hello, Amanda.
Hi, Bex. Hi, Liz. Nice to chat to you both.
Hi, Amanda.
So today I know we're going to have so much to cover and I can't wait to get stuck in. So before we get into the stories about how and Liz helps me so much, and how we met, let's just let the listeners know a little bit about osteopathy, if I can even say the word. So we all kind of know what a physio and a chiropractor is, and I'm sure our listeners do. But Liz, will you be able to speak to us about what is an osteopath and how they are different?
Well, osteopathy, interestingly, is different according to what country you're in. So an American osteopath would be seen as a doctor of osteopathy, whereas in the rest of the world, and certainly in England, Scotland, Wales, i.e. UK and Europe, osteopathy is a degree course. It's where you learn how to examine people, not just for musculoskeletal injuries, but you have to be able to determine whether or not somebody has a simple backache or has a something underlying that simple backache or neck ache or arm ache or whatever. So that the osteopath basically is trained to determine a musculoskeletal injury, whether it be bone, soft tissue, ligament, whether it be a joint, whether it be a complex range of problems. So it might be, for example, that you have a pronated ankle, so your ankle tilts inwards because you've got flat feet. And as a result of that flat foot, the knee is becoming stressed because the knee is no longer working in the midline. And so the osteopath would then carry on up to the hip and determine what influence that pronated foot is having on the hip. And then they would have a look at the, okay, so the hip's being affected by the fact that the whole joint chain is being distressed by the flat foot. And then would look at how that affects the low back and so on. So in other words, you're looking at a whole body. And with that whole body, you would then determine, A, you've got to look at pain, because obviously pain is what people come to you for in the first instance. So for that pain, an osteopath tends to use a lot of tools, which is slightly different from chiropractic. And physio can use tools or it can just use exercise, whereas an osteopath might use soft tissue approaches with their hands. They might use electrotherapy. They might use, for example, I have a certificate in dry needling, which is essentially remedial acupuncture. So I might use needling. Obviously, I can't do that on a horse because in the UK, it's illegal for anybody other than a vet to actually use acupuncture needles on a horse. But I can certainly do it on my human patients. So an osteopath will use multiple tools, which does include mobilizing joints or manipulating joints. So the known high velocity thrust, which everybody here thinks of as the cracking of a joint. Now we have multiple tools, and but the ethos is where it comes in. We're looking. So I might, for example, have somebody come in who will be, I've got really I'm short of breath and my ribs feel constricted. So you could deal with that just as a rib issue or a breathing mechanism issue. And you might use, as say, soft tissue techniques, myofascial fascial techniques. Or you could start to ask a few questions and say, well, do you know, what's going on in your life here? You know, when do you find this breathing problem emerges? And then you might find by a little bit of questioning and a little bit of, you know, just general gentle probing about the lifestyle of the person that they're actually suffering from anxiety. So in addition to, looking at their breathing techniques to try and enhance their ability to breathe, you might actually bring in, for example, square breathing. You might recommend that they actually go and see the GP and perhaps have a discussion about their mental health. So in other words, you end up being a bit nosy in some respects because you're poking around in somebody's case history or history to try to help them make better choices, make better, sit better in their working seat, you know, sit better in their driving position so that they can maintain a comfort and they can maintain a quality lifestyle. So it's quite a broad approach. And with the horse, for example, I would be looking at the horse, you know, moving, I'd be looking at it in the stable, I'd be talking about its behavior. I would see it move long before I actually put my hands on it, because I'm much more interested, same way as I am with humans, really, I'm much more interested in what they're trying to do dynamically, how they're managing their body. And then I might come back to, well, you know, the saddle might be influencing the horse, the shoeing might be influencing the horse in a negative. So we can have a discussion with the farrier, we can have a discussion with the saddler. We might also, for example, if they come into me and they're profoundly lame, an osteopath does not deal with lameness. The lameness has to be referred on to the vet. Well, and in fact, physios, chiropractors don't or shouldn't deal with lameness, because that's actually not our domain. Our domain is to support the lameness, to support the movement patterns of the horse, to make it, or the human, to make them feel comfortable, have all their joints moving to their full capacity, to be able to use all of their muscles in a balanced way so that no one group is actually more stressed than another. So, I mean, a typical situation with a horse is the horse tends to go the default position into an extended spine. So they go hollow, don't they? And the hind legs come out behind them somewhere. The head goes either up or down, you know, depending on whether they're on the forehand in a stargazery type way or on the forehand with a loading head down position. And those back muscles, those epaxial muscles, become very, very shortened and quite often compressed and sore. So not treating the back is okay, but you've got to look at why, you know, what's happening here. Now, okay, if the horse then has HOP, DJD, degenerative joint disease, you know, which is a fairly typical position of most horses, or they've got hind leg suspensories, there is no point me just treating the backs, because I'm not going to get anywhere, because the hind limb needs to be functional in order to have a functional back. So whilst the vet is treating the suspensories or maybe medicating the hops or doing whatever they need to do there, I will be supporting the vet, the recovery of those hind limbs, by increasing the range of movement, maybe through the neck, the thorax, through the lumbar sacral junction. I'll be looking at so that's a joint, if you like, mobilization. I might be looking at and treating the epaxial musculature, which has become flattened and shortened with the, you know, the rider sitting on it or the horse's body position, at which point I might use things like radiofrequency treatments. I might recommend a TENS machine, for example, which the owner can use for themselves. I might use muscle stimulation, generally of the to try to stimulate psoas or the hip flexors, which actually also contributes to lumbar sacral flexion, along, you know, with a combination of rectus abdominis and then the psoas, which together create that lovely movement at the lumbar sacral junction that we want to swing the hind limb forward. And that tends to be my approach. I mean, obviously there's then individual differences between practitioners dependent upon their experience. You know, I'm sort of into about 160,000 horses now, but that's because I'm an old woman.
I've been around
a long time and I've seen a lot of horses, and I've been very fortunate in that position to, by seeing so many. I was around when there were very few of us, you know, very few practitioners of any description, at which point, you know, the 2.5 million horses that were there in the country were, you know, split between maybe half a dozen of us. Now you're 2.5 million, because the horse numbers don't seem to have gone up much in the UK, are split between, you know, loads and loads and loads of different types of practitioner, as we've already stated. So I've seen a lot, and I think that's really helpful in terms of modifying. So, new things come in, new treatments come in, new electrotherapies come in. But the ethos is still the same. It's try to make anybody functional throughout. So that's mentally, physically, bones, joints, soft tissues. And you're also looking at the movement. You're not just looking at a static situation. It's a dynamic function that an osteopath would be interested in, not just a is that knee, you know, working, or is that joint work, one joint? It's what's the knock-on effect? Anyway, I've rambled an awful lot there. I hope that's answered the question.
No, that's an
absolutely fantastic answer. I think it's gone really into depth and it will really clarify what it is you do, and that it's not just looking at bones, which, to be fair, some listeners would be thinking. And I think before I'd met you and realised how you worked with the horses and worked with myself, I'm a lot more knowledgeable about it now, thanks to you. So should we just speak to listeners about how we came to get together and how you came to work with me? I remember, well, back when I was a student at Hartbury College, I had a little pony, a jumping pony, and she went a bit wrong. It was all down to, I think, her feet not being shod very well, which then she started to compensate through her back. So she came to you at the therapy centre at Hartbury and you worked with her. We then had quite a big gap where we didn't interact.
Well, that's because you didn't believe in it, you see. That was the trouble.
And now I'm complete
convert. You know, I was a snotty teenager who thought
I was a 16-year-old that just got, I just wanted to crack on and ride my pony if it wasn't able to jump.
Don't
then
tell me it's injured, just let me ride it.
Exactly. And I think that's still kind of my ethos of it. I'm like, and I still even say that to Liz, and she's telling me about, you know, this is working, that's working. Now I understand it a bit better, but to be fair, I will turn around and be like, well, can I jump him?
Yeah.
That's my, you know, can I still ride him? Is he going to be all right to ride? And then I leave the rest to Liz and the expert vets.
A few years ago, I treated a horse for an owner that was with Tim Stockdale. And I remember going there and he said, and I'm trying to go be protective of it and want him to encourage him to do, you know, still sort of help the horse a little bit as much. And basically all he was interested in, can I ride it or can't I? And I think that sums up most riders, you know. Don't tell me what's wrong with it. Just tell me if I can ride it.
Yeah. If it's going to be comfortable enough to go and do its job. And that's how we actually got to meet a bit later on in my life. We had about an 8-year gap or something. I was working for Tina and Graham Fletcher, and Liz's daughter, Rachel Launder, was working there. She was nanny for Will Fletcher and Ollie Fletcher. And we became really best friends when we were working at the Fletchers. And then that's how I came to meet Liz again. So we had a bit of a gap. I went off competing abroad. And when I came back and set up on my own, I then came to Liz. Actually, Rachel got pregnant. That's what it was. Rachel got pregnant. So the wonderful show jumpers that you had bred that were meant for Rachel ended up being brought my way. So I had the pleasure of producing Skell with Lady Delilah from a 5-year-old who then went on to compete internationally. And had some other fabulous young horses of yours. So shall we just start with me as a rider and what you used to find with treating me that other riders would be able to relate to? I know I first came to you, I wasn't aware that I was actually wonky. But then I had some ankle injuries as well, where you've had to work into our regime to keeping me riding fit. So what does being posturally fit mean?
Well, in a nutshell, it means being able to use all of your body efficiently. And now to be efficient, you have to have a structure that is balanced. So, for example, if you think of gravity acts downwards, pushing you down at all times. So if your head is in front of your neck, for example, so you've got a head forward position, then the gravity will be acting to push your head further down, which tends to mean that you will lean forward. Also, apart from anything else, gives you headaches and neck ache, but it's a very common position. So from to be posturally efficient, posturally fit, you would need to bring that head back to try and put it over the trunks, because the trunk, essentially the feet carry, support the limbs, support the pelvis, supports the spine, supports the head. And everything is about the head, you know, we need to be able to see, we need to be able to function. So our brain needs to be protected. So we really need to keep the body underneath the head. What tends to happen with modern life in particular, you know, like your text neck, for example, where your head is beginning to come forward, you know, you're balancing over a computer, where you're working, mucking out, you know, anything which takes you sort of into an asymmetric position, where you're using particular movements frequently. I mean, if you just take, for example, mucking out, you know, it's flexion, side bend, rotation. And depending upon whether you do one or 21, as some of my patients do, whether it's legal or not, it's beside the point. But they're mucking out a lot of horses. So that's a lot of forward bending, side bending, rotation. So it's essentially a stress pattern of movement. So to be posturally fit, you've somehow got to offset that. So the rider who rides, you know, maybe mucks out four or five stables and then goes and gets on a horse, A, without warming up, because most riders think mucking out is warming up, whereas in fact you should warm up to muck out. And most riders don't warm up to get on their horses, they just get on. So you're carrying with you, whether it's an amateur rider who rides one horse, or whether it's and somebody who works in an office the rest of the time, or somebody who does manual labour and then goes and rides on their horse, or somebody who rides a lot of horses and just gets on one after the other, they need to be posturally efficient. So they need to be able to control their body without force, without having to use specific muscle groups that actually are overused, if you like, so that you're at one particular position. And I think the event riders amongst you might actually notice that over time your shoulder blades migrate to the side and your shoulders become a little bit internally rotated, so you're a little bit rounder. So when you look at the pictures of kids riding, I mean, obviously I do some junior teamwork. When you look at the kids, they still have a reasonable posture. By the time you look at them in their mid-20s, they become round-shouldered, they've got big, bulky muscles on their upper arm and their shoulder, and they're often complaining of pain between the shoulder blades. But often it's called a burner or a stinger, you know, stinging pain between their shoulder blades. And this is because the muscles that actually control the scapulae, or the shoulder blades that pull them towards the midline, have actually got very long. So that's a situation where you become posturally unfit. The shoulder blades are no longer controlled. They're no longer held to the midline, so that your pecs, the muscles at the front, which should be the same, if you like, equal and opposite to the ones on the back of your body, are no longer, they become shortened and round. And I bet you if I dug my fingers into either you or Amanda's, literally just in front of the shoulder, you'd be going, because they become short and tight and sore. And so that's an example of being posturally unfit. Now, the other thing that tends to happen is, like, for example, with you, Bex, when you had your ankle issues, is that you compensate for those ankles somewhere else. So your knees got very stiff, and so did your low back.
Yeah.
Because you're naturally inclined to be a bit hollow backed, which is quite a common position we find. We've found through some research at Hartbury that it's lordosis, hyperlordosis of the low back, in other words, a hollow back, is actually quite common in women particularly, less so in men. But that does have its disadvantages posturally.
That's sticking your bum out?
Yeah, absolutely, sticking your bum out. Yeah. So which having a bit of a wiggle with it behind you is not ideal on a horse. Or anywhere for that matter. But yeah, that's exactly that.
like duck's bum. So sometimes I think
absolutely, trying to
sit up really straight, you end up sticking your bum out the back rather than actually sitting up straight. I've got to say, the more you talk about posture, the more I'm sitting here like trying to sit up straight.
I know, same. My rounded shoulders, squeezing my shoulder blades together.
Oh, I said, having that beautiful posture is not as easy as we think that it is, isn't it? Because you sit up straight and then you end up losing the flexibility and the movement through your pelvis to be able to sit on the horse and go with its back. So, yeah, what you're saying is really interesting, and it is a bit difficult. What about flexibility? So how important is that as a rider?
To be flexible is in anything, but particularly for riding is really important. Riding is different from really most other sports, and it requires a degree of symmetry. You know, you've got you're sat astride something. So you need to be asymmetrical, but the joints need to move equally, if you like, on your left and on your right. So most people, when they are on the floor, if I ask them to hop round to the left and then hop round to the right, will have difficulty going one way because they're naturally asymmetric. This comes with right-handedness and left-handedness. Now, unfortunately, that confers a degree of inflexibility in one range of movement, which means that if one range of movement doesn't move as well as it should, another is moving too much or is too controlling. So flexibility from in any direction, being able to rotate. So, for example, if you, I guess a lot of people saying to me, I'm really struggling with half past left compared with half past right. Or that mostly it's probably the other way around. They struggle with half past right rather than half past left because they're naturally rotating all the time to the left. So they have become inflexible to the right. So actually just what that means is that they're no longer symmetrical in terms of their movement. So they may need to be encouraged to move to the right and develop a right, the ability to move or turn to the right. And that requires that the joints move, that the muscles are balanced around the joints and that the tendons and ligaments allow for that movement. In other words, they allow you to be flexible. Similarly, the low back, as you just said earlier, Amanda, when the people, you know, try to sit up straight, they become rigid because they're trying to hold a position. Now that again means that you're no longer flexible. Now there's a negative to flexibility. Those people who are hypermobile really struggle. Mm. Now hypermobility is great in a gymnast and in a ballet dancer because they learn to control it. But in a rider who probably doesn't do much other than ride, it doesn't allow for that control. So you can be overly moving, which means you can't maintain the balance on the horse. So to be flexible confers all the joints, it affects all the joints. So your ankles should be able to be soft and mobile, the knees should be actually not rigid, the hips should be able to function, the low back needs to be able to function, blah blah blah, up the rest of the body. So it's a terribly important thing because you cannot otherwise sit comfortably on your horse. You can't be a comfortable load for the horse to carry if you're stiff or rigid or opposing its movement. So, yeah, massively important.
Everybody talks about the importance of core stability in horse riding. So, you know, tell us the importance of core stability and
tell me, what do you think core stability means?
Well, I would think that the core is not just the stomach muscles. I would say that it was the muscles both that or around the pelvis. So everything that stabilizes your upright position. So the spine, how the legs attach to the pelvis, the front, the back, everywhere around it. Am I on the mark, sort of?
I think that's pretty fair. Most people do think of the core as just being the abdominal muscles, which is a great shame, because actually being stable means that your trunk is balanced and held properly over the pelvis. So to do that needs a neutral spine, in other words, a spine which has its normal curvature, and then a pelvis which can be neither tilted forward nor tilted back, but just held nicely in the middle. Now, for that to happen, the muscles around that trunk pelvis intersection need to be balanced. So they need to be equal and opposite in strength. So the front muscles on the front of the body, need to be balanced against the muscles of the back, the quads, they will need to be balanced against the hamstrings. Psoas, for example, the hip flexor muscle, needs to be balanced against the gluteal muscles. Now, glutes on the whole are massively underused in riders, massively underused in people generally, unless they're athletes and training.
And so I don't use my glutes very much.
No, well, then what happens, and again, in eventers and jockeys, for example, you see this a lot, is they become very forward. The knee, for example, and the is because it's always held closer to the hip than, for example, in a dressage rider, psoas gets shorter. If the quads are weak, psoas becomes strong, too strong, and then you lose some of the flexibility at the hip and lose some of the flexibility at the low back. Now, obviously, if your core muscles are able to are strong enough and well balanced, you'll be able to sit up easily. You'll be able to move easily and maintain the control of your trunk over your limbs. Now, the one group of muscles which is generally forgotten about in core are the pelvic floor muscles.
Not by my friends that have had babies; they remember about them a lot.
Yeah, so any of the people who've had children will probably have been told you must do your pelvic floor exercises. But in fact, in the vast majority of women, they don't. And unfortunately, the woman's bladder is not a very successful evolutionary story. And so without those pelvic floor muscles, we can end up in real difficulties later on in life. Now, men don't suffer quite so much, but they still are. But the pelvic floor muscles are part of your core groups. Essentially, they control, they support the pelvis too. And if the pelvis is supported, you can carry your trunk. If your trunk is carried uniformly, easily, then your core is good, you know, your core muscles. So it is literally the trunk muscles from side to side, back to front. And then if you like the leg support, so that I believe for me, the psoas and your glutes are part of the core. So it's a very, overrated, i.e. over talked about, understood, for, you know, part of training. And if I get nothing else across in this podcast, get your pelvic floor muscles involved in the core.
Oh, tomorrow's work. I'm going to add that in. What about you, Bex?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is really good for our listeners to understand that. I mean, I thought the core was just about my stomach muscles until I started going to Liz. But so another thing which I've struggled with is my foot balance and my ankle strength. And obviously, if we're a little bit wonky on the horse, this is going to affect the horse's way of going. Can you speak to us a little bit about what you look for in a rider being symmetrical and whether foot balance and ankle strength affects this?
Well, I mean, essentially, and when we're not on a horse, we're normally walking, unless we're sitting, of course. But, you know, in other words, we're on 2 feet. Hopefully. And if you have the feet essentially support the trunk, support the body. So if you're, I'll give you a case scenario. I have a patient who has very small feet, very high insteps. So that means that they're very arched. So she has a little bit of a height sort of issue on those, in that she's tall, but she's tall and broad, but on tiny feet. It's quite quite difficult for her. Most people sort of have the feet that they need, if you like, but in this instance her feet are really small, and as a result of that she has constant foot pain, ankle pain, because the feet are being overloaded by the body. And it wouldn't be so bad if they weren't so highly arched, which of course makes shoes a problem. But it drives the weight into the forefoot, if you like, into the big toe. And so her big toe is constantly, the joint there is constantly sore and swollen with the weight on it. So it's a really significant thing. So somebody who's flat-footed, for example, might collapse, or they might be flat-footed on one side. And if they're flat-footed on one side, that means that the ankle will collapse inwards or downwards on the inside ankle bone, the medial malleolus, as it's called. And then what happens then is that that side of the body is lower than the opposite side. So your knee height then will be different. And if your knee height is different, then so will your pelvic balance. So that one side of the pelvis might drop to that foot. And then that means that when you're sat on a horse, for example, you'll collapse. You know, your weight, one side of the waist will collapse as you're trying desperately to remain in balance on the horse. So the ankle then becomes, and it's no good for the coaches, this is always very difficult, because all they see somebody in boots. They don't see the foot on its own. They probably don't have time to look at the wear, and particularly if you only wear your boots for riding, there'll be no wear pattern on the bottom of the foot to actually actually show you what's happening. So the coach will start to talk about, because that will often ramify right the way up through to the shoulders. So, for example, I hear very commonly when we've done coaching conventions, people will say, well, you need to lift the shoulder. Now, we're not coat hangers. You know, essentially, the floor supports us. You're not supported from the top of your body. So if you've got one shoulder down, then there's no point trying to lift that shoulder, because it's not going to help you at all, because actually the problem started at the floor level. So, the poor coach is struggling to try to keep what they see in front of them, symmetrical on the horse, whereas, in fact, really what needs to happen is on the ground. Now, that person with a collapsed foot or the collapsed arch, may well require an orthotic. So they might need to go to a podiatrist and have their feet actually cast, and then have an orthotic which supports the foot on the ground. Now, that's okay until you get on the horse. So you can start at the foot, but you will need to actually support the body through that weakened side, because on the horse, obviously, it's taken out of the equation, but the ramifications of that collapsed ankle have not been. Now, if you're riding with a painful stiff ankle, people tend to offload. They don't tend to put their weight into the feet. Now, I mean, I like, for example, in my warm-ups, people to walk on their toes and walk on their heels. So they start to strengthen their ankle and start to strengthen their arches. I like people to do foot exercises. So, for example, curling the toes, picking up sticks, picking up, remember, for those of you at school, playing jacks. Remember playing jacks? So, picking up anything with the toes. Similarly, rolling the ankle from side to side to keep it as mobile as possible, because the worst thing you can have is a stiff ankle, because your weight again is then transferred to the opposite side of the horse. And so what people tend to do then, if they have a stiff ankle, they quite often will lock the knee as well. And if you lock your knee, that might well push you in a in a rotation, so that the body, the bum goes out to the, say it's your left foot, your left knee and ankle is damaged, your left knee is stiff, you might swing your bum to the right. So okay on a left turn, but not so okay on a right turn. Say you're doing a jump off turn or something, you land, and you might be that you're always putting the horse to one side. Now, okay, that might also mean that the horse's saddle is moving to one side or moves to the side that you push away from. Now, unfortunately, that becomes an issue, because something like 87% of horses who have saddle slip are actually lame behind. So it might be that you're blaming you, it might be that you're blaming the horse, but it actually might be a combination of two things. So it's always important, if you've got saddle slip, to look at yourself, but to look at the horse as well. But the ankle, the knee, any joint which becomes immobile or becomes damaged must be maintained in order to keep that all-important symmetry we need on the horse. Because if you're not symmetrical on the floor, you certainly aren't going to be symmetrical on top.
So true, isn't it? I even can think of some of the clients that I've taught, and I know one girl that has a real lack of flexibility through the ankle. And I don't know if this is a suggestion that you might make, but we ended up lowering her stirrup iron on one side. Otherwise it just shot up the body. So it's fascinating how, Liz, you're looking absolutely everywhere. It's not just that obvious place that's the cause of it.
I love feet.
Oh, wow, that's an interesting
And that's another episode.
And what was interesting there, I think, which I'd like to touch on as well, is you talking about how it affects you being a rider on the horse. And that's what we work really closely about with my rider performance, is we do all the exercises off the horse to be fit to ride, which I think is a lot wider knowledge now, that we as riders need to be athletes and not just work on the horse, do our exercises off the horse to improve. You've touched on that you do some acupuncture. Well, I've had some acupuncture from yourself, and also use the TENS machine. What other sort of treatments do you do on the human athletes to help them?
Well, my approach with humans is, I suppose you could, some people would call it, some perfectionists might call it a blanket approach. Yeah. I like to, first of all, are we looking at pain or are we looking at stiffness? So I've got to try and determine what's the immediate impact that needs to be made. So if somebody crawls in and can't turn their head, or, can't weight load their knee, for example, that the first thing is they're in pain. So you've got to try to alleviate the pain. Now, the thing that happens is, and it depends, the difference is, if you've got a chronic problem, something that's been there for quite a long time, so say over 3 or 4 weeks, then normally we heal through the inflammatory process. And everybody, of course, the first time they bang their knee or bang their ankle, they'll take an anti-inflammatory, which is a real no-no. We shouldn't be taking anti-inflammatories, because we heal through inflammation. Yes, take a painkiller, something like a paracetamol or something, but if you're taking any of the drugs that actually inhibit the inflammatory response, then you're actually going to slow down the body's ability to heal itself. Now, if you just take the use of shockwave, for example, extracorporeal shockwave, that is something that I can use. I can use it both on a horse or a human. It's not required to be a vet or a doctor that uses that. And it might be something that you'd like to use where you've got an animal or a human which has ceased to heal itself. It's remained static. There's no longer any healing going on. There's pain, there's dysfunction, there's perhaps muscle wastage. So in that situation, you might want to stimulate the inflammatory process. So that's what my view is. When I've got somebody who comes in, is it acute or is it chronic? Or is it an acute on chronic? In other words, a chronic condition which is having a flare-up. The typical thing would be then a disc, you know, where you've got a grumbling disc problem where the disc is the annulus is fissured and you're getting the middle of the disc, the sort of watery bit in the middle, just creeping to the outside and then back in again. And those can go on for years. And so you might have an acute flare-up. So the immediate thing is there, is it nerve pain? Have I got referred pain? Have I got local inflammation or excessive inflammation? Or have I got local swelling? And so what I might do then is I might use anything from my hands. I might use ultrasound, for example. I might use laser, depending on how deep the structures are if I want to be. I might use something like radio frequency. I might use mobilization. Rarely will I use ice with a chronic situation. I might use it in a very acute ankle to limit, for example, some of the swelling or ice is about pain relief. But you don't want to be using cold for too long because obviously that inhibits or switches off the inflammatory process, which is what we need. If I've got somebody who's come in and they've got chronically a frozen shoulder or a dysfunctional shoulder range of movement, then I might want to really generate some inflammation, in which case I'll probably stick my fingers into it, which is quite often produces a lot of screaming.
I was going to say painful.
Bex, you know all about that by the sounds of things. We've known Liz long enough.
I have screamed many times in Liz's treatment room, I tell you. She's had me squirming and screaming and thinking, what am I doing here? But always come out feeling a little bit better, maybe a little bit dizzy, but a little bit better.
Oh, goodness me.
But the tools that you use are determined by what have I got in front of me? You know, what are the injuries? What are the patterns? What's the person like? You know, can they tolerate pain or are they, you know, if, for example, somebody who is fragile, who might be suffering from osteoporosis, which might be a young woman who is overtraining. So young women who overtrain might actually stop their periods, they might be not eating enough for their workload, and they may be actually loading their tissues. But in fact, you might be then moving somebody towards an osteoporotic situation. So they're fragile. So you wouldn't use too much. You'd have to be careful about how you handle the body in those situations. The same way that an elderly person, you know, elderly women particularly are known for osteoporosis. But actually, by the time most men are 75, if they're sedentary, they will have osteoporosis too. So you wouldn't want to use a high velocity thrust, for example, a mobilizing technique on their back, if that's the case. But in the same way, if somebody came into me, for example, who'd had a mastectomy, I wouldn't be. You would have to be tender in the way you actually help these people. So I might use again. I might use. There's where I might use remedial needling. You know, I'm not an acupuncturist because that's a specific training. What we do is remedial acupuncture, those of us who use dry needling techniques. And they're very, very useful with the human. But as I say, radio frequency, which is a really useful tool. It all depends also on how often are you going to see this person, because not everybody can afford to be in as often as they'd like. So, you know, you might be able to send them away with a TENS machine or encourage them to buy them. They're very cheap and they are brilliant for pain relief. They don't cure, although there is some evidence to support that if you can support pain relief, it does allow the body to heal. There is some evidence coming forward on that front. But certainly TENS works on the sensory nerve. When it's on, it's working. If it's not on, it's not. So if you only use it once a week, it's not no point. If you only use it once a month, then, you know, don't waste your time. Because for that five, you know, half an hour to an hour, it's on. Now, a TENS machine can actually be used more or less all day and is a great tool for pain relief and for making somebody comfortable, whether it's a neurological issue, you know, whether you've got a neuropathy or whether you've just got a painful joint. But again, anything you use has to be determined by the, you know, what dosage do I need for this person? That's including a manual techniques. Or what's the end game? You know, where am I trying to move them to? So somebody who comes in, for example, with an acute problem, relatively easy. Somebody who comes in with a chronic problem that needs to be moved from a static position of discomfort, disuse, underuse or misuse, you've got to move them towards use. So you've got to control the pain. You've also got to then put exercise in there as well. And people generally have a little bit of a problem coming to the therapist because they expect the therapist to do the work. But actually, the therapist merely is like the conductor in an orchestra, actually is telling, you know, supports and starts and sort of controls what happens. It might, you know, you might be putting the tools in there, but the person who's got the injury needs to cooperate too. And compliance is often a big issue. You get more compliance with people with their horses than you do with people for themselves.
It is so true. We've talked about this before between Amanda and myself that our horses will get down to the T. Our horses will have the rehab, but the riders sometimes don't put the work in themselves.
That's so true, isn't it? And we do. We give everything to our horses. But I must say, I completely agree with you with a couple of injuries that I've had. And I've thought to myself, God, if I don't do this now, this is, you know, I'm not going to be able to fix this later on. And it is. If we would be as diligent with ourselves, and it does work, doesn't it? It's like you could ride 10 horses a day, but when you're doing the same thing over and over again, you have to do something a little different. And equally to the amount that you're doing the other thing. So like you were saying, the push and pull of the body, it's got to be equal, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
We want to know now, we've talked so much about the rider, that what reasons should we bring our horses to you? So why would we call an equine osteopath? Is it for neurological issues such as like head shaking or head tilts or lack of coordination or behavioural issues, like maybe just grumpiness or aggression or the good old bucking?
Well, the majority of the reasons that I get asked to look at a horse are for poor performance. So the horse is simply not functioning as they want it to do. Now, that poor performance might manifest as bucking, rearing, disagreeable behaviour. But behaviour for me is always a window to the horse. You know, it's trying to tell you something on the whole. It might be that it's got ulcers. It might be that it's got overriding dorsal processes, i.e. kissing spines. It might be that it's had a pinching saddle and its muscles up, but it's trying to tell you something. So behaviour is very common. Equally, it'll be, well, my horse has started tripping, or my horse is, my canter lead on the left is good, but my canter lead on the right is poor. It might be that they are just, for example, a fairly recent one was where a horse was perfectly okay until about its third round, you know, so it went out maybe and did the British novice and it did the jump off or whatever, and then it might go and do the discovery, and then they might go, oh, well, I'll go and see if I can do the newcomers. And then it would start to just take out a rail. Now, you could argue, and this is what they did for ages, oh, it's fatigue. But the horse is relatively fit. It's in regular work and should have been quite capable of doing those rounds. So they asked for me to have a look at the horse to see if there was actually anything that I could, you know, help them with to improve on it. So obviously I'm looking for is, what can I make a difference, you know, to that animal? And if I can't, if you're seeing the horse, I like to see them walk and trot on the hard surface in a straight line, on a circle on a hard, and then I like to see them walk, trot, canter on the soft. And then if there's a problem in the ridden, I'd like to see them ridden, because, you know, you can walk and trot a horse or canter a horse on the lunge, but you've not got it loaded, have you? So I like to see them actually do whatever their job is. Now, it's a bit difficult to, if you've got a horse that's coming in, it's after three rounds, it's suddenly starting to you know, lose its shape or drop a leg or take a fence out. Nearly always the last fence in this particular horse, which was quite interesting. And I'll say they just thought it was fatigue. But it then turned out when you study the videos, it was always a right off a right turn, and it was always out of, you know, so always coming off the right, a right turn. So in right canter, and nearly always not took it out with the right hind. So fortunately, I had been able to see the videos. Now, if you didn't see the videos, if you didn't have those videos, I would have to go to a competition and actually watch it for long enough to see what it was doing. Because if there's nothing there in front of you, you can't just poke at them and go, oh, well, that's the reason. Because everybody has pain. Wherever you touch, you know, whatever you're doing, you will have some discomfort somewhere. And so just actually prodding and poking, and go, oh, yes, that's a bit painful, isn't going to actually give you the information you need. It's the pattern of movement I'm interested in. So I would then, you know, try and find a common pattern of movement that creeps in. And if you need to fatigue it to get that common pattern, then fine. And then you start to investigate what's going on. Now, in this instance, there was an enormous amount of shortening of the quarter muscles on the right hand side. There was therefore a tilt, an axial rotation of the pelvis and movement. And there was some discomfort in the sacroiliac region. So you could have surmised that it was just going to be sacroiliac pain. But actually, I felt it was more than that. So we, with combined then, is when I work with the vet, which is what I like to do. You know, there's no point working in isolation. Because, yes, I can help the musculature, I can help the movement pattern of the lumbar sacrum and the sacroiliac. But in this instance, the horse had a low-grade suspensory. So we were able to determine, and that's the only time, and it wasn't lame, it was purely, so when they eventually, they obviously, the animal was scanned and there was damage to the suspensory. So it was then shockwave, we treated the sacroiliac joint, treated the upper body, and away it goes. Now that would be very typical, and in fact it's going on very, very competitively at the moment. That would be typical of why somebody might come to me. It's just not right. It's just not performing well. It's just something not quite, or they would like, equally, they would like to say, well, can you just check it over anyway? Because I'm regularly working it and I'd like it to be, you know, maintained comfortably. But very often I'm unfortunately at the bottom end of, I'm the last person to see them, usually when there's been a long history of problems that have been looked at. Another case, for example, recently was a horse that was really struggling to, again, carry the weight of the rider comfortably. It had had surgery, spinal surgery, i.e. overriding dorsal processes. It had had a long period of rehab and didn't seem to have actually improved at all. It then had the facet joints medicated in the thoracolumbar spine, where there were some changes, bony changes. And that still didn't make any difference. So I was asked to look at it. Now, one of the common things with diabetics, for example, human diabetics, is that their muscle tone feels very different from somebody who is not a diabetic. And their joint range of movement might be restricted by that muscle tone. And the only thing I can describe to you is it feels a bit like cold potato. It has that sort of texture instead of a nice mattressy, elasticy feeling. So in this last, like in those situations, I will often look for in the horse, for example, where you can't get, I will look at metabolic issues. So I, in this instance, I felt that the horse quite possibly had one of the metabolic syndromes. And the first one you normally go for is, you know, equine metabolic syndrome. Although polysaccharide storage myopathy, PSSM, can often be again at the root. Now, It did have PSS, it did have EMS, cut a long story short. And the only reason so I'm a good detective, really. So that's why I get to see a lot of my horses. And I think that comes out of, I think it's helped by the experience I've had. You can't treat something, and you shouldn't be treating something if it doesn't respond to the treatment. You know, if you're having to repeat and repeat and repeat, you've got to ask yourself, what are you doing? You know, are you actually treating the correct injury or pattern. And I think that's the sort of thing I get a lot. It's sort of the, well, this hasn't worked and that hasn't worked, so can you have a look? Which I used to feel was insulting.
Yeah.
now I feel I'm privileged to actually help.
Whereas over the years, I've learnt that, and actually you're my first go-to wizard that I call you to look at my
horses. I know you
don't
like what I say half the time.
No, I don't, but I still bring them to you.
I want to ride it. Just let me ride it.
Why isn't this one going as well? And do you think, with the horses that you see in general, do you think that over the years, the concerns that you see and the issues that they have, do you think they come from genetics, or is it a job that we're asking them to perform?
That's interesting. About the genetic thing.
Well, I guess I'm quite a good person to ask that of, seeing as I'm ancient.
No, I was actually going for the fact that you have actually done a lot of world-class breeding, Liz, not for the fact that you're old.
Well,
so those who don't know, Liz has been breeding.
What's interesting is that the horses, the competitions have changed, haven't they? And the horses have had to change too. I mean, if you think of the show jumpers of the 1990s and early, you know, the 80s and 90s, they were great old boats, weren't they? And they only had one canter; it wasn't very adjustable, and they just sort of, you know, pushed on down to the fences. I mean, okay, there were a few exceptions, like, you know, Stroller and things like that, but on the whole, they were big old things that actually could jump a house but couldn't necessarily turn or roll back or do all the things that you need to do. And similarly, the event horses have changed with the roads and tracks, you know. And also people have changed in that they've become a bit heavier. I'm very pleased I'm sat behind the screen here and you can't see the rest of me, by the way.
Don't talk rubbish.
We've become a bit heavier, and we've also become people have become a lot more sedentary, haven't they? So they don't, you know, unless you're a professional rider, you're perhaps not exercising, you're sat a lot of the time. So people aren't as balanced as they were. And one of the other things that's happened too is that you know, we're still asking the horse to do more and more and more, but we're not necessarily, the horse hasn't changed, has it, really, in the sense of it can't change its basic shape. You might make it lighter, you might put a bit more thoroughbred into it, you might make it able to turn more quickly, and you might make it more flexible. But fundamentally, it's still walking on one toe, isn't it, you know? And I think a lot of our problems are that if it has talent, despite the fact that one leg might be pointing one way and one leg might be pointing the other, we will still compete it, you know? If it can just, it's like the racehorses, isn't it? Doesn't matter what they look like, but if they can run quick, there you get them bred from. And so we pass, I think, unfortunately, there's still an element of luck in producing horses, in that it doesn't matter how you've got to keep looking at the genetics, you've got to keep looking at I mean, I particularly like to use horses that are old, stallions that are old, for example, that have remained sound in their competition, or stallions that have, so for example, a very good youngster that is out of my Skelleth Diamond Lady, who James Emblem rides, she's by a horse called Kalaska de Semilly. Kalaska de Semilly is by Diermont de Semilly, so, you know, everybody knows Diermont de Semilly, very, very, very successful horse. The reason I particularly use Kalaska de Semilly, he was ridden by at 18 in, for example, the Asian Games, and other, he also went to Beijing. He was ridden by a girl who wasn't necessarily in the top flight of riders. In other words, she came from a country where they didn't have a history necessarily of show jumping, but that horse at 18 was still sound and jumped with the girl. Now, I'm on the whole breeding for, I was breeding for my, you know, for my, for women. I breed for women generally. Because I do believe, you may shoot me down, I do believe they need a different type of horse from a man. If you've got cramp on legs, yes, you can ride a barge. But, you know, I don't want to ride a barge. I'd like something that's light and whippy and, you know, and looks after itself.
So, well, Amanda and I are very similar stances, so we can totally agree with that.
Oh, no barges here. No barges.
No.
We're both about 5'3" and 5'4", and neither of us have any barges in the yard because, I mean, I don't know about you, Bex, I can't, like, when my hips externally rotate, I'm done for. That's the end of that. No barges here.
Yeah, we don't want to take half an hour to turn a corner. We like them whippy and light on their feet.
And that's what I'm interested in. But of course, we've had to change those horses as well. So inevitably, in changing a boat into a sort of lighter whippy, I mean, that's where I started with a boat. It was brilliant, you know, jumped internationally, but it was brilliant at its time. But it wouldn't be horrible now because you'd need a turning circle of about half a mile, so it would never get, you know, you'd never get to your fences. However, so I've had to take the basics, which is the jump, the stature, the attitude, the trainability, and then, you know, add to or improve. Now, in that improvement, I try to make sure I don't use horses that have bone chips, for example, that have a hip. But we don't always know that, because honesty is not always there, is it? There's a big, for example, at the moment, a big movement towards making sure that polysaccharide storage myopathy is actually tested for. So, for example, Appaloosas, you cannot get into their stud book unless your horse is free from PSSM. It's such a debilitating condition. But a lot of the breeds, particularly, for example, in the warm bloods, they've not been keen. When the stallions have been diagnosed, it's a bit like the fragile foal syndrome, isn't it? They've not been keen to actually have it, you know, known. Mm. And so we can't always help what we get if you don't have all the information. So I think DNA profiling is probably the way ahead. I mean, we know now, for example, that overriding dorsal processes have a genetic background. So, unfortunately, every time you operate on something, you're actually promoting the operation as being the health. Okay. Whereas I actually think we shouldn't be breeding from those horses. The genetic profiling is such that you can either have extreme disease, moderate disease, or a susceptibility to disease. So, it's a massive problem now. You know, horses are being in the UK particularly operated on all over the place. It's not so, they don't operate so much in Europe, and I don't know about Australia, but it's a massive problem. And you have to ask yourself, you know, why are we breeding from these animals if it's such a problem? Yes, the vets get paid, but we don't necessarily get what we need. So I think
that's something
we should be looking more at what not to breed rather than what to breed.
Yeah, and I think that's something in the UK is becoming hopefully a little bit wider known. I think people do talk about it now, looking into the mares, the dam line, and the sires, and making sure we're breeding longevity into these horses as well. I mean, but this is a whole other episode that we could talk about this. I know it is. So let's make sure we don't go off on that tangent. So for our listeners, are there anything like preventative care that you can do for our horses, assuming we've got no underlying issues? Are there any basic stretches that we could do at home or to ourselves?
Well, I would say, first of all, I hate stretches because most people think that they are really good for them. But essentially, a static stretch is a really bad thing to do. So I actually prefer warm-up. I also think cross-training. Cross-training is something that the horses should do. So, and that means that they should go on multi-terrains, they should get out of the school, they should go onto hard surface, they should go onto irregular surfaces, provided, as we say, that they have no known issues. They should go uphill, downhill, they should do poles. It doesn't matter what discipline you're in, they should do something that makes their joints go through multiple ranges of movement. They should go backwards. Rein back's a fantastic exercise, particularly in hand. It's the only time I like to use a back band. A back band, we've done some research at Hartbury, which actually shows that if you use a back band on your horse that's doing rein back, you increase the range of movement of its lumbar sacral junction. Most horses go hollow. our best exercise is to oppose that hollowness. So if you do nothing else, then get it in hand and make it go backwards, because it's not going to hurt it, it's going to benefit it.
That's so good to hear, Liz. I love a rainbow.
Warm up, you know, warm up. Do literally anything on the spot. Jogging, arm, range of movement, go to the ceiling, go out to the side. Go, you know, if your knees hurt, your ankles hurt, then maybe don't jog so high, but just go up on your tiptoes, walk around the room, go up on your heels, walk around the yard, you know, move all of your body. Yeah. And then if you need to, before you get on, my favorite stretch, if I'm going to use a stretch, is a dynamic stretch, and that would be a lunge. So
okay.
That way you actually stretch the hamstrings, you switch them on, you oppose a little bit of the on one side, the psoas, whereas at the same time you're also looking at a bit of static knee control and hip control whilst you stretch. And I would have the arms out to the side, and I would rotate left and right, and then I would also take one arm down to the floor so that you're going up that way to the, and it's one of my favorite stretches. And then I'd follow that with some glute bridges. Now, most times gluteal bridges are badly done. So people lie on the floor, whack their pelvis up into the air, so their back's hollow and they've got their feet flat on the floor. A good gluteal bridge.
I've done it like that.
Yeah, a good gluteal bridge basically should have arms out to the side. You switch on the abdominal muscles, not by sucking in, but by tensing them as though somebody was going to punch you in the gut, mm-hmm. and you were going to protect your internal organs. You bring your knees as far as you can, close as you can get, your feet as close as you can get to them, to your bum, and then you put your heels into the floor and lift your toes up. You then switch on your glutes by compressing. You've got to imagine that you're in a room and you've just had a terrible, curry, and you've got a terrible desire to fart, and you actually have to hang on to those that moment. You squeeze everything, and then you lift, and you lift literally as far as you can without.
I'm not going to forget this.
Without going hollow. So you're only going up a little way.
It's the curry exercise.
That way you're hard on your glutes, you're also controlling your pelvic floor, the all too often forgotten muscles. Those are my favorite go-to exercises.
That is just fantastic. Next time I'm eating a curry, I'll be thinking of doing that exercise for sure.
Give me your next move the next morning.
Oh dear. And on that note, we have been talking for over an hour, and it's just been super good. It's been super interesting. And I can't thank you enough, Liz, for coming on and sharing all your knowledge with us today. It's been great. So on that note, I'm going to close everything there.
Bye.
Bye, Liz.
Bye.
This has been the Equestrian Experience with myself, Bex Mason, my co-host, Amanda Ross, and this episode's guest, Liz Launder from Hartbury University Therapy Centre. To send in your questions for our up-and-coming episodes, enter our competitions, and access our other episodes, be sure to visit the equestrianexperiencepodcast.com. You can follow us at Amanda Ross Equestrian and Bex Mason SJ, and find Liz at Osteopathy for Horse and Rider Hartbury University Therapy Centre. Until next time, have a great equestrian experience, guys. See you.
Thanks, Bex. Thanks, Liz.